Welcome to the 46th episode of Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Brandon Scalia. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Onc Live is also home to the State of the Science Summits. These summits, which take place throughout the United States, are dedicated to the latest research in various therapeutic areas. That brings us to today's episode. We recently traveled to Dallas, Texas for a State of the Science Summit on Breast Cancer. At the meeting, faculty from Baylor Scott & White Health System and the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center relayed the prognostic value of genomic assays in breast cancer and the scope of established and ensuing treatment approaches for those with early stage and advanced disease. First, we spoke with the chair of the meeting, Joyce O'Shaughnessy, MD, co-chair of breast cancer research, chair of breast cancer prevention research at Baylor Simons Cancer Center, Texas Oncology, chair of the U.S. Oncology Network, and a 2016 giant of cancer care and community outreach. O'Shaughnessy prefaced our interview by laying out the latest updates in metastatic hormone receptor positive HER2-negative breast cancer before segueing into the clinical implications of the TEXT and SOFT trials for women with premenopausal HR-positive HER2-negative disease. O'Shaughnessy explained that while 8-year follow-up findings from the TEXT and SOFT studies provided considerable insight into the use of adjuvant endocrine therapy for women with premenopausal HR-positive breast cancer, more follow-up is needed to fully understand how stopping therapy at 5 years will impact disease-free survival. Listen on to hear more from O'Shaughnessy on the unanswered questions that remain with adjuvant endocrine therapy.
The most important practical point for practice with regard to premenopausal endocrine therapy is that we really have learned now from the SOFT and the TEXT trial with 8 years of follow-up that women who have very indolent, low-risk disease, they're not going to get chemotherapy, they may do fine with tamoxifen alone, provided they're not too young, under the age of 35 or even up to maybe 40. But if they're over 40 and they have very indolent, low-risk disease, tamoxifen is fine. Conversely, if they have very high-risk features, larger cancers, node-positive, younger age, highly proliferative, grade 3, progesterone receptor negative, the more of those factors you have, the greater the benefit from an aromatase inhibitor plus an LHRH agonist. So we're beginning to be able to personalize the therapy for the premenopausal woman, and it's critically important because endocrine therapy for the premenopausal estrogen receptor positive woman is by far the most important therapy. So getting that right and utilizing an aromatase inhibitor plus an LHRH agonist for the patient with the high-risk features is critically important, with up to a 15% absolute benefit in distant disease-free survival. So that's by far the most important practical point. One of the groups that we worry about are the overweight and obese women, particularly the obese patients, because there's some data that it's harder to suppress ovarian estrogen levels as thoroughly with LHRH agonists plus an aromatase inhibitor in an obese woman compared to a normal weight woman. So that's a little bit of concern, particularly if she has high-risk features. And the data show that really with a highly proliferative grade 3 aggressive breast cancer, progesterone receptor negative, she really is better off getting an aromatase inhibitor plus an LHRH agonist. But if she's substantially overweight or obese, I think we better monitor ultra-sensitive estradiol levels and really see if they can be suppressed less than 10 picograms per ml. The question is, would she be better off having a bilateral salpingo oophorectomy, getting the ovaries removed, and that may be the case. So that's the one area in the ABCSG12 trial. They showed that overweight and obese women didn't do as well with an LHRH agonist plus an aromatase inhibitor compared to normal weight women with the aromatase inhibitor compared to tamoxifen. So that's an area of some controversy. We want to be aware of that and probably monitor the ultra-sensitive estradiol levels in the substantially overweight or obese women. In the SOFT and TEXT trials, unfortunately, about 20% of women who are premenopausal did not finish their 5 years of therapy. There's considerable side effects for these younger women with regard to menopausal symptoms, dyspareunia, lack of libido, arthralgias, fatigue. There's a lot of side effects. And women over time, unfortunately, about 20% just stopped the therapy. The other area of concern is with the LHRH agonist, in the Sofdin text, it was given every 4 weeks. It's very difficult to come in for 5 years every 4 weeks on time. And if the ovaries start breaking through because the LHRH agonist is gone, particularly if a woman's on an aromatase inhibitor, the AIs can actually stimulate ovarian function if the ovaries are not suppressed with an LHRH agonist. So though the clinical trials utilized every 4 weekly, I tend to use a longer depot formulation. I don't really trust it to last 12 weeks. I usually will go 10 weeks, and that gives the woman a little bit of wiggle room to if she's a week late. And then just to be on the safe side, I do check the ultra-sensitive estradiol levels when she does come in and make sure that her ovaries are still suppressed, because I'm just concerned that every 4 weeks is going to be very difficult for women to get in kind of religiously, et cetera. If women are a little bit older, they're into their mid to later 40s, it's just easier for them to go ahead and have an oophorectomy. It's just the younger women, particularly those that are, you know, under 40 or right around 40, early 40s. Right now, the standard of care is 5 years of an LHRH agonist and stop. And so they would regain ovarian function, you know, many of them, depending on how much chemotherapy they had had, et cetera. But adherence and sticking with that therapy for the full 5 years is critically important to a woman's outcome, critical. But unfortunately, some women just can't put up with the side effects, basically.
Subsequently, we asked Mariana Chavez-McGregor, MD, MSc, about the optimal applications of genomic assays in patients with early-stage, HR-positive, HER2-negative breast cancer, and the overall outlook of personalized medicine in this setting. Chavez-McGregor, an associate professor in the Department of Health Services Research, Division of OVP, Cancer Prevention and Population Sciences at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center, said that the collective results of the MINDACT and TAILOR-X trials provided a better directive in terms of whether or not to give endocrine therapy alone or in combination with chemotherapy for patients with node-negative, early-stage HR-positive, HER2-negative disease.
I think that in patients that are HER2-positive, HER2-negative, with early stage, something that has really come to change clinical practice, it's the use of genomic platforms. These tools are helping us identify patients that are not going to need chemotherapy, and that way we can preserve, or, you know, these patients can have great outcomes without the toxicities of treatment. The data from the TAILOR-X trial that was presented at ASCO in the plenary session by Joe Sparano really demonstrated that patients with node-negative HER2-positive tumors that have recurrence scores between 11 and 25, the addition of chemotherapy has no benefit. The only caveat there is that in young patients, particularly those younger than 50, there might be a benefit of chemotherapy, but these tools are really changing how we practice day to day. So what we want is to cure this patient, right? And what we want is with our systemic treatments prevent a recurrence, that it's what eventually can kill our patients. And in patients with hormone receptor positive tumors, we have two tools. One, it's endocrine therapy, and we know that patients with hormone receptor positive tumors should receive endocrine therapy. But the question is, which patients need chemotherapy? Because if we give chemo, all of them are going to have side effects, but we're not going to benefit all of them. So I think that's the key question. And of course, we're evaluating that now also in patients with node-positive disease. So there's clinical trials, and particularly the responder trial, we're waiting to the results to see if those patients with 1 to 3 positive lymph nodes that have recurrence scores less than 25 benefit or not from chemotherapy. We do have retrospective data in this group of patients that suggests that the biology continues to be very important, that even in this group of patients that have higher risk, because they have lymph node involvement, those with low recurrence scores might not benefit from chemotherapy. Now, we have data from another genomic platform that it's called MammaPrint from the MINDACT study that actually included patients with lymph node involvement that shows that, you know, patients that are high risk clinically, but low risk by this genomic signature have excellent outcomes, meaning adding chemotherapy, it's probably not necessary. So I think that's an area where we're also starting to think differently. Many patients with lymph node involvement continue to receive chemotherapy, but I think we're learning more about how to tailor the treatment and personalize it based not only on the extension of disease, which is what we've done traditionally, but also on the biology.
Chavez McGregor also spoke to recent shifts in the treatment of patients with metastatic triple-negative breast cancer. While the impact of the March 2019 FDA approval of atezolizumab plus nab-paclitaxel in patients with locally advanced or metastatic PD-L1 positive triple-negative breast cancer is unmistakable, she asserted that other agents of considerable merit include PARP inhibitors and antibody-drug conjugates.
Well, triple-negative breast cancers are very aggressive cancers, and for many, many years, the only treatment that we've had to treat triple-negative breast cancers is, you know, standard chemotherapy. These are very exciting times where we're starting to see other agents that now we can use day-to-day in our clinic. What really has come to change and give us one new tool, it's immunotherapy. So the use of atezolizumab was just approved a few weeks ago in first-line setting in combination with nab-paclitaxel patients with PD-L1 positivity in the immune cells. And particularly in this patient population, there was an improvement in progression-free survival. And while the overall survival data, it's exploratory, there seems to be, you know, an advantage there. So this data brings finally to the clinic the use of immunotherapy in breast cancer. There are, I think, still many unknowns. We still need to, you know, determine what's the best way to determine PD-L1 positivity. Different trials have used different assays, different cutoffs, what's the best combination with chemotherapy, but at least we're starting to get our feet wet in the world of immunotherapy. There are a number of clinical trials evaluating immunotherapy in combination that I think are really, really exciting. And while we are exploring that across the breast cancer world, meaning all breast cancer subtypes, there's of course a lot of interest in triple negative. Now, other drugs that have also become available recently that are changing the way that we think about these tumors are PARP inhibitors. Now, this is not specific for triple negatives, but a lot of patients that have BRCA1 and 2 mutations have triple negative tumors. And now we have two PARP inhibitors approved. Both of them got approved last year, olaparib and talazoparib. So those are the results of the Olympiad and Embraca study, respectively, in which patients were randomized to receive the PARP inhibitor versus chemotherapy, in that case, chemotherapy choice of the treating physician. And in both cases, patients treated with the PARP inhibitor had better outcomes with actually even less toxicities. And again, it's bringing a new target. Now there are even trials combining PARP inhibitors with immunotherapy. So it's a very exciting time. And again, just in the last, you know, year, we have now three new drugs to treat these patients, which gives us more tools.
As in triple-negative breast cancer, the field of HER2-positive breast cancer continues to gain traction in terms of therapeutic developments since landmark approvals in the space, said Cindy Osborne, MD, a medical oncologist at Texas Oncology, Baylor Charles A. Sammons Cancer Center. In our interview, Osborne highlighted the many advances that have been made in the treatment paradigms of locally advanced and metastatic HER2-positive disease.
Catherine was one of the most important trials that came out last year, was in HER2-positive patients who had been treated preoperatively with HER2-targeting chemotherapy and had residual disease. And so they were randomized then to receive postoperatively T-DM1 or trastuzumab. And the result was a pretty dramatic difference between the two arms. So there was a 50% improvement in terms of developing invasive and disease-free survival, and also a reduction in the distant disease-free survival as well, from 10.6%, as opposed to in the non-TDM1 arm, over almost 16%. Well, I think neoadjuvant therapy has become pretty much the standard in HER2-positive and triple-negative breast cancer specifically. And for larger tumors, node-positive, it definitely is going to, it gives us an idea about sensitivities to different drugs. So why miss that opportunity? So then in the adjuvant setting, though, T-DM1, no pathologic complete response situation definitely showed an improvement in outcomes, and there was no difference by hormone receptor status, as has been seen like in some other trials.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to the 46th episode of OncLive on Air. Check back on Wednesdays for new interviews from our State of the Science summits. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com. and sign up for our e-newsletters. We have two upcoming State of the Science summits for those interested in attending. If you'd like to familiarize yourself with more of the latest data in breast cancer, register for the June 27 State of the Science Summit in New York City, New York. We will also be holding a State of the Science Summit on Lung Cancer on July 1st in Atlanta, Georgia. Register now at onclive.com/meetings/SOSS. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at @OncLive and @OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive on Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive on Air.